Welcome again to our study of Joshua. I am your host, Bob Resch. With me are my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. I've been intrigued by the Gibeonites who show up in Joshua chapter 9, and I have some questions about them and about God's instructions to his people, which might involve Gibeonites and maybe some other people. I read in preparation for these discussions a number of places where God says, look, you, when you crossed the Red Sea, how much fighting did you do? None. Did you kill many Egyptians? No, I did it. All I asked you to do was stand there and watch me do it. So I grouped those just for my own disposition of people, existing inhabitants, by God. And then there are other texts where God says, yes, these people have to move, and you need to move them. I'll hand them over, and you will drive them out. You must drive them out. You will quickly conquer them and drive them out. All right, are those the same concept or perhaps different? Then there are others, texts, these people need to be annihilated, and I'll do it. Other texts where these people need to be annihilated, and you do it. I'll back you up, but you need to do it with your swords. And I'll bless you for doing that. So if I were Joshua, I would be a little bewildered by all this instruction, which seems not to go all the same way. If you were Joshua, would you be at all bewildered?
Well, I guess I could say, sitting with students over the years and reading some of these texts, I think what I can speak to is our experience of sitting with these texts. And many of these texts, if you sit down and try to read them from cover to cover, so to speak, you may experience something like whiplash. Like you might feel like you're physically being jerked in multiple directions without time to recover between. Uh-huh. And so I think that that's worth naming, you know, that we don't sit alone, because these stories, which we've said were then like passed down as a way to explain circumstances or family lines or any number of things, would have been then gradually collected into smaller collections. And then those collections may have been edited together into things that turn out to be more like the quote unquote books that we have before us now. And that's a long, drawn out process informed by all kinds of concerns. But when we sit down to read a book like the Bible, I think it can be easy to forget that it was not written as a book. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a library of books, and each of these books is a collection of collections. And many of those collections came to be over long periods of time, you know. And so sometimes I think we can sit alone in our room, we read this and we think, am I crazy? I feel like I'm being jerked here and there and I'm so confused. What does God want and how am I supposed to know? And we can lose sight of the fact, first of all, that we're not crazy for feeling that sort of push and pull within mm-hmm. the narrative. It is truly there, and it's there on purpose, because these scriptures are an invitation to this ongoing wrestling dialogue. But also we lose sight of the fact that these stories were not meant to be told and ingested individually. They were told in group contexts. They were encountered and dealt with in group contexts. And so we lose that piece also. And so we forget that when we do feel jerked here and there by the text, this was intended to be experienced in a communal setting. And one of the places that we see that in Joshua, you know, Joshua is one of many descriptions in the Hebrew Bible of what we call covenant renewal ceremonies. Mm-hmm. In Joshua, you know, we have this picture painted at the end of chapter 8, for instance, is one of these examples where, you know, you have all the people, they gather and they read aloud every word of the book of the law, and everyone is in the hearing. It's a huge communal oral event. And then you have specifically speaking to this, what you said could be bewildering, right? Combination mm-hmm. of commandments. You have in the description of this covenant renewal ceremony that not only the Israelites, including the women and children, but also the aliens that reside among yes. them are there with them, right? So within the text itself, you have these competing threads that we have to grapple with as we encounter the text. And then I would just, you know, point out that the whole covenant renewal experience is not only described here, it happens over and over with various circumstances in other books of the Bible. And so there's this communal, and it's assumed, right? It's just a given. The alien is there. God often is quoted as saying, "Remember, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You were aliens," right?
So and how do you treat aliens then?
Yeah, so many times in the Hebrew Bible, the people are told, "Remember, you were once aliens," right? And so be careful how you treat the alien. And all these threads are here, and we're not meant to grapple with them alone.
Thank you. Dr. Frey?
We love that part of the Bible where the slaves are freed from slavery, and so they are not aliens anymore. In Egypt, they were aliens. Mm. So God brings about the liberation. But now, as we come into Joshua, those who were aliens are supposed to become inhabitants. And here is where the story becomes problematic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We love the first part, but we already know that it's turning into something from the positive, from the liberation aspect. Now it's turning into the other side. And that is the story of the human way of dealing with things. And we live in a country where that has happened.
Yes.
It happened in the biblical story. And in the biblical story, according to our traditional historical way of reading it, it happened thousands of years ago. But it happened here just a few hundred years ago, where people under the slavery context move across the ocean and now come into a place where now the question is, what do we do now?
How do we become inhabitants?
How do we become now inhabitants?
And if we're all people of God, do we want to divide ourselves by degree of education or place of origin or color of skin or income? And, you know, if you look and think like me, you're good. And if you're not, well, you're not, of course. Is that something we want to do in the Bible? Is that something we want to do here and now?
Well, I think one of the things that is easy for us to forget, or maybe I should say it's a question I think that we should ask ourselves as often as possible and not be too sure we know the answer. So keep asking the question because we have not arrived at the final conclusion. And the question is like, how are these stories functioning? Like, what does it do for a human person who's feeling scared, who might be hungry, who might be uncertain about the well-being of their family? Maybe they have aging parents. Maybe they have young children. Maybe they don't know where they're going to live. Like, how does a narrative like this function for people who are simply trying to survive human existence? And I think many times in Western Christian contexts, we've grown up hearing the story of Joshua told through the lens of someone who automatically has all of their basic needs met, right? And then we're told, here we are all sitting comfortably, and God told Joshua to go kill everyone. And so now there's going to be a time, maybe God's going to tell us what we need to do, and we need to go forth and do it with courage and strength. And I remember last year or the year before, I had a conversation with Jenna Morgan, who is an indigenous scholar who is studying Hebrew Bible at Princeton. And she was talking about the experience of standing up in her church and being asked to preach about Joshua. Uh-huh. How do you do that? How do you do that? How do you sit with these texts? And she talked about remembering, like, Israel in the ancient Near East was a petty kingdom, right? There were moments of peace. Shlomo, Solomon, he reigned in a time of peace on every side, but those were fleeting moments. Overall, they lived in many times constant fear. There was shifting empire powers. They were at the crossroads of huge powers who could basically just step on them. They could just start attacks or send an army and Israel would just disappear. So they are the underlings. They are the fragile. They are the group that is many times terrified. And can we read these texts and say there are moments that one could feel so afraid that maybe the only thing accessible to them is to say, I am going to flail out and do everything I can to protect my family, and I believe God is telling me to do so.
Well, what about the passages that say the whole idea is terror? Whether the terror comes from God or from Israel, get out of here. I'm going to scare you out of here. Now, I'm thinking of nonviolent ways I might move. If my house and my yard were beset with stinging insects to the degree that I couldn't live there anymore, I would go away. I would find some place to go. And the Bible uses a word which is sometimes translated hornets. I guess there's some real question about what that is. Maybe it's terror. What is it? Anyway, there are reasons to move besides avoiding extermination. Could God have persuaded these people in less violent methods?
I'm always intrigued when there is a natural catastrophe, like a huge, you know, storm or something happening here. And then as soon as it stops, people rebuild in the same place. What do you make of that?
Well, they may not have insurance, but they do it, yes.
But they stay in the same place, and you know full well this is a region that is really, you know, disaster is like attracted to this place, and people still remain there. So.
Now, some commentators have said, no. God didn't really want the Israelites to go smash and burn people. They would just smash and burn idols. But in the book that we're reading, there were lots of people smashed and burned. And how many altars and idols did Israel smash and burn in the book of Joshua?
It's not an emphasis in this particular narrative.
Now, if we wait to Judges, Gideon did some smashing and burning of idols there, but not in Joshua.
No. And to that, in the preparation, I was listening to two interpreters on this, and they mentioned that archaeologists have not actually found, yes, the text gives us these accounts of a lot of, like, idol worship or even child sacrifice and so on. So it is present, but it is not in the sense that it would not have been later on. So the amount of, you know, the presence of idol worship in the time before the kingdom of Israel is present also in the time of when Israel has its power. And so there is not a big difference between peoples like the Hivites, Canaanites, Hittites, and so on, and then the Israelites afterwards.
Yeah. Now, several times the reason for extermination is given, they will entrap you. If you're at all kind to them, they'll entrap you, and you'll be worshiping false gods, and that's going to be terrible for you. So here we have, today we've considered two occasions where Israel was merciful, to Rahab and to the Gibeonites. Do we know whether either Rahab or the Gibeonites entrapped Israel in idol worship? I don't think so. So what should we learn from these stories? Well, we're coming to the end of our time again. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to Dr. Fry. Thank you to Dr. Washburn. Thank you for our excellent technical help. And next time, we'll have more study from the book of Joshua. I'm Bob Resch. This has been The Good Word.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.